Acts 15 continued. The 57th talk in a series on the Book of Acts was presented by Jack Crabtree on February 25, 2001 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2001. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle. This is the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side.
I'm going to turn to chapter 15. We just finished the bulk of chapter 15. Chapter 15 is where the elders and the apostles meet in Jerusalem together to decide the issue, do you have to be a Jew to be saved? And they come to the conclusion that God has already spoken on that issue through the miraculous signs that he has had accompany the conversion of the Gentiles, that God has already spoken and said, they are acceptable to me, they are my children. And on that basis, the elders and the apostles in Jerusalem decide, how can we decide differently than God? That settles the issue. And then they wrote a letter to the churches who were, the letter to Antioch, the Christians at Antioch, explaining their decision. And we've talked about that. In verse 30, then, we pick up from, the story from there. So when they were sent away, they went down to Antioch, and having gathered the congregation together, they delivered the letter. When they had read it, they rejoiced because of its encouragement. Judas and Silas, also being prophets themselves, encouraged and strengthened the brethren with a lengthy message. After they had spent time there, they were sent away from the brethren in peace to those who had sent them out. But it seemed good to Silas to remain there. But Paul and Barnabas stayed in Antioch, teaching and preaching with many others also the word of the Lord. After some days, Paul said to Barnabas, let us return and visit the brethren in every city in which we proclaim the word of the Lord and see how they are. Barnabas wanted to take John, called Mark, along with them also, but Paul kept insisting that they should not take him along, who had deserted them in Pamphylia and had not gone with them to the work. And there occurred such a sharp disagreement that they separated from one another, and Barnabas took Mark with him and sailed away to Cyprus. But Paul chose Silas and left, being committed by the brethren to the grace of the Lord. And he was traveling through Syria and Cilicia, strengthening the churches. Okay, Paul, Barnabas, and some people from Jerusalem return to Antioch. They read the letter, and the other prophets, Judas and Silas, who have come along with them, spend some time teaching in the church at Antioch. We don't have much details, but there's obviously a span of time where there's some interchange, some more interchange. There's been constant interaction between Jerusalem and Antioch over the years. There's some more interaction with the prophets and teachers from Jerusalem coming to Antioch and teaching. So we have a time span here. But after a while, he says, we get on to the next phase of this thing. Paul decides, says to Barnabas, let's go visit those churches that we started during our first journey. Now, you remember the first missionary journey, they took off from the seacoast of Antioch. They went over to Crete, traversed the entire island of Crete, went up, took a boat north to what is now the southern coast of Turkey, to what then was called Pamphylia, at which point one of their traveling companions, a young man named John in Hebrew, Mark, it was his Greek name, John Mark, left them and went back home to Jerusalem. His home was in Jerusalem. Then Paul and Barnabas and probably others traveling with them continued the journey and started those churches that we have already seen in Iconium and Lystra and Derbe and Pisidia and Antioch. Paul wants to go back and visit those churches. So he says to Barnabas, let's go back and visit the believers in those community and strengthen them. Barnabas says, great, yeah, let's do that. Let's take John Mark. Paul says, no. He deserted us the first time. I'm not taking him with us this time. It's not at all clear to me what Paul is thinking, what his concern is. I just don't think we have enough details, enough facts to have any kind of idea of what exactly is at stake here. Did John, when he left, did he somehow leave them in the lurch? I mean, what if he's just a traveling companion and he decides he doesn't want to go along any longer and he goes home? It seems like a pretty petty thing for Paul to be concerned about. If he was offering some kind of substantial help and support of some kind that he is no longer offering them by leaving them, and so he burdens them with an extra burden that he had been lightening when he was traveling with them, then it's understandable that Paul feels that they were abandoned, that they were forsaken, John Mark had been irresponsible, had been unloving in leaving them without the assistance that he was offering them. We just don't know, though. I mean, we don't have the kind of information that it would allow us to know what Paul is thinking. Whatever the reason, Paul has obviously takes a strong stand here. Barnabas wants to take him, and Paul is so dead set against it, for whatever reasons, that Barnabas and Paul come into what Luke calls sharp disagreement. Some real bitterness happens between them. A bitterness so sharp that they end up not traveling together. Barnabas does take John Mark, and they begin the second missionary journey to retrace the steps that they had followed originally by going to Cyprus. Paul takes Silas with him, one of these men who has come up from Jerusalem. He joins him in an expedition to go basically take their journey backwards. He goes to Derbe first, which was the last church that they had planted on that journey. I want to pause and think a little bit about this sharp disagreement between Paul and Barnabas and the implications of that. In the end, I think the record shows that Barnabas was right and Paul was wrong. In 2 Timothy, Paul makes a reference to John Mark, a very positive, favorable reference to John Mark. Evidently, that over the course of the next several years, John Mark proves himself to be wise, to be supportive, to be mature, to be responsible. In one of the letters, Paul makes the comment, "Greet John Mark," or something like that, who has been of great service to me, Paul says. So by the end of the New Testament, we get a portrait of John Mark as having proved himself to be of great value even to Paul personally over the course of his journeys and his ministry. So as has always been the case in the story of Acts, Barnabas was right. Barnabas discerned the spirit, the maturity of this man, and knew that this man had a lot to offer and there's no reason that he shouldn't come along with us. Paul doesn't see it. Now, can we blame Paul for not seeing it? No, I don't think so, not necessarily. Paul, I think to give Paul the benefit of the doubt, we have to assume that Paul had very good rational reasons for thinking that John Mark has demonstrated so much irresponsibility in the past that he can't trust him at this point, at this juncture. Barnabas, as we have already seen, is an extraordinarily discerning individual. If you remember what we talked about earlier in Acts, Barnabas is the one who heard Paul out, the younger Paul, who had been a persecutor, a murderer, a serious enemy of the Christians, and who had come into town making this claim, "Oh, by the way, I'm one of you now. I saw Jesus on the road to Damascus, and now I'm one of you." And as you would imagine, that wasn't received real well. You know, the Christians in Jerusalem said, "Yeah, right." And they didn't want to have anything to do with them. But Barnabas heard him out, and Barnabas listened to him, and Barnabas was the one who welcomed him into the Christian community, took him around, introduced him to people, and basically encouraged the people to be open-handed in their support of Paul. If there had been no Barnabas, there would have been no Paul. Barnabas, I think, single-handedly is the one who gave the necessary foundation and support for Paul to be able to have any kind of foothold in the Christian community at all. This is the same man who's saying to Paul, John Mark deserves a chance. John Mark deserves a second chance in this case. He's a person of substance. He's a person of faith. He's a person of wisdom. There's no reason we can't take him along. And I think the record shows that Barnabas was judging rightly. Paul, on the other hand, did not have that kind of discernment. He didn't see it. He probably was a less discerning person with respect to people than Barnabas was, and he had no reason to think that that was true of John Mark. So I assume that we can expect that Paul is making a good, sound judgment based on the resources that are available to him on the one hand, but so is Barnabas. And they come into reach an irreconcilable difference. That's going to happen between believers. We are finite, we are limited, we are not gifted in every respect, and so we are simply going to come into situations where you and I just see things differently. We don't see it the same way. One of us is right, one of us is wrong, or both of us are wrong, but we just don't see it. And we are not being stubborn in not seeing it. We are not being irresponsible in not seeing it. We're not even necessarily being evil in not seeing it, but we just don't see it. But how do you deal with that kind of situation? I think not the way Paul and Barnabas did. They reached a sharp disagreement. The sharp disagreement caused there to be some kind of alienation, some kind of tension. I'm assuming that. I mean, the text doesn't actually say that in so many words unless the Greek word art necessarily connotes that, and I have no way of knowing that. But it looks, from knowing what we know about human nature, it looks like this sharp disagreement has so alienated them from one another that they can't travel together. So they have to part company and go their own ways. That is not a good thing. That is a bad thing. It is a symptom of the brokenness of human beings, the moral brokenness, the evil, the moral inadequacy of human beings. If we were perfect people, we could submit to one another. We could take risks with one another. We could trust one another. We could give one another the benefit of the doubt. Paul and Barnabas, or at least one of them, was unable to do that. I have no evidence for this, but my suspicion is that it's Paul who was unable to do this, and not Barnabas. My suspicion is that the guiltier party in this matter is the Apostle Paul. He's just being stubborn. He has a basis for his stubbornness, but there's a stubbornness that sets in that creates an evil alienation and antagonism, not some kind of mutual submission to one another. If that's the case, and regardless of which one it is, or both of them, the point I'm about to make is still sound, right, and the question that raises is still a valid question. What do we do with the fact that the person who has proclaimed and articulated and exposited the gospel to us in the New Testament is such a jerk? What are we going to do with that? And it raises the question that we face in our lives all the time. Who do we listen to? And by what criteria do we decide who is trustworthy as a spokesman for the gospel, for the faith, and who is not trustworthy? If we judge a person untrustworthy because he is evil, then there's nobody left to listen to. I think that's one of the important lessons of this passage. Paul, in all of his writings, never pretends to be a good person. There's no pretense in him. He never pretends to be above sin, to have settled the issue of sin in his life, to no longer be evil, to no longer be self-centered, to no longer be a jerk. He's not making that kind of claim. But there's a tremendous temptation in all of us, I think. I have felt it a number of times throughout my life as a believer. A tremendous temptation to assume that if somebody is wise, then they are good. And when they show themselves not good, to question whether they are wise. I can remember when I was a college student, there was a Bible teacher that was very influential in my life and in the life of a number of my colleagues. And I remember one evening sitting around the dinner table, having dinner together at our house, discussing whether this man might actually be an angel instead of a human being. I've never seen him sin. Have you ever seen him sin? Has anyone here around the table ever seen this man sin? And no one could cite one instance when they'd ever seen this man sin. So we were joking, of course, but there was something very half serious about this conversation. The half serious part of it was not that we really believed that he was an angel, but we really did believe that he was such a remarkable man that he had put sin behind. He had left it behind. And it was a thing of the past in his life. He has transcended his evil and sinfulness. Tremendous temptation that we have to believe that of the people that we want to listen to, that we want to allow to instruct us, that we want to allow to lead us into wisdom. But I think we have constant warnings throughout the New Testament, and the biggest warning of all is the actual teaching of the gospel itself. Because the teaching of the gospel itself is predicated on a fundamental assumption, and that is every human being under the planet, the only exception being Jesus himself, Jesus the righteous, Jesus the just. The only one who is sinless is Jesus. All the rest of us, every human being throughout all of human history, is fundamentally evil at the core of their being. So any one of us are capable of horrendously self-centered, self-serving, unjust, cruel, insensitive, unloving actions. And I think what we're seeing here, probably on the part of Paul, maybe on the part of Barnabas, maybe on the part of both of them, is we're seeing here an example, an instance, an occasion where their evil just manifests itself. It just couldn't help itself, but it exploded out of them in this sharp disagreement that led to alienation between two people who had, I mean, what's incredible is look at what they had gone through together. Look how deeply bonded these two people had been in their lives. They had suffered persecution together. They had been in this thing together. They had to have a deep friendship, and yet this thing split them apart. I think the evidence suggests that that did not last. It healed over time. They were able to reconcile their differences over time when they got some distance from it. But for the time being, it split them apart. Why? Because human beings are evil. And to call it anything else is to not see reality and human reality realistically, human beings realistically. Realistically, that shouldn't surprise us of them nor of ourselves. So how do we know who to listen to? The issue, and this is the distinction that we need to learn to recognize and we need to understand. It's important for our own, for our own wisdom's sake to recognize and be able to work with this distinction. There's a difference between being evil and being foolish. And the difference ultimately comes down to every evil person is capable of destructive, ultimately selfish, ultimately perverse attitudes, actions, choices, desires, and so on. Every human being will manifest some of that some of the time. But what makes a person a wise person is that they are authentically, and I underline and underscore authentically, is that they are authentically committed to righteousness as the values that they want to define their existence by. Not as evidenced by their teaching, not as evidenced by their words, but as evidenced by their actions and their choices. We don't have the record of how Barnabas and Paul were reconciled when they were reconciled, but presumably, reading from the nature of wisdom as the New Testament describes it, it would have involved a bit of self-reflection on Paul's part or on Barnabas' part or on both of their parts. A bit of self-reflection. for they were able to first and foremost say to themselves, about themselves, I was a jerk. I was too stubborn. I was too proud. I was too blind. I was not acting the way a human being was designed by God to act. Shame on me. I stand guilty. I am blameworthy for what manifests itself in my attitudes and my actions. And then, having come to that kind of self-reflection and that kind of self-knowledge, had the courage and the humility to be able to go to the other person and say to them, what I did was awful. And here's what I did. Here's who I am. What you saw was the evil person that I am. And would you forgive me? Now, I don't mean this as a formula. Whether this actually went down this way or not is immaterial. What's ultimately important is that they did own from within their own will this bit of self-knowledge about themselves. The foolish person is the person who seeks to avoid that self-knowledge to the end of their days. I will not believe of myself that I am that bad. I will not believe of myself that I was in the wrong. I will not believe of myself that what came out of me was not actually their fault because they provoked it in me. They drew it out of me. They put it there. I'm basically a good person. It's just the people around me who make me bad. And we find all different kinds of ways to rationalize and shift the blame and redefine who it is that I am in such a way that I don't look so bad. I don't look unworthy. I can still walk away going, I'm worthy. I didn't perform so well, but not because I'm not worthy. I'm worthy. The conclusion, the beginning of wisdom, besides what the Bible actually says is the beginning of wisdom, what Jack says is the beginning of wisdom. The beginning of wisdom is that foundational knowledge that I am unworthy in God's eyes. I am not acceptable to Him. And my whole life proves it. My whole life shows it in the stuff that comes out of me. It's okay to be a jerk as long as you know and acknowledge that you're a jerk. It's okay to be a jerk. It's never okay to be a jerk, but you're not going to avoid being a jerk. And the only thing that's left to us is to acknowledge the fact that I am that unworthy, that I am that selfish, that I am that cruel, that I'm that awful. To acknowledge that, embrace that, own that, and with every fiber of my being, strive against that. To try to allow my life to be lived according to a different vision of what it means to be a human being than what comes naturally to me. I won't succeed. I'm going to fail. I'm going to fall on my face. But at least I will call my failure failure, because that vision of a different way of living is so important to me that I'm not going to give up on that vision. I'm going to call myself a failure before I redefine what I think a human being should be. One of the things that we do when we think through the questions, the ethical questions that our culture poses, notice how much pressure we feel to define right and wrong, good and bad, based on my own performance. Oh, the Bible can't say that's sin. I do that. I mean, how tempting it is to say, if there's any possibility, if there's any wiggle room at all, to be able to lower the standards of morality as I interpret it in the Bible, to make myself look better, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to lower the standards because I don't want to have to face the fact that I'm actually bad, that I'm actually unworthy. So we'll lower the standards. That's the kind of foolishness that comes so naturally to us. What characterizes wisdom within us is that willing to call it exactly what it is according to the high standard of what God would call good and right and appropriate, and not our deflated values. I think Paul is well worth listening to. I think Paul is a worthy spokesman for the gospel, but he's a jerk. So we cannot dismiss people based on their evil, but we should be very, very discerning and very ready to dismiss people based on the inauthenticity of their commitment to the values of the kingdom of God and the truths of the gospel. In that regard, I think as a culture, as a larger Christian culture, we are far too willing to listen to someone just because they wax eloquent about loving God and loving Jesus. Don't watch their lips, watch their lives. The question is not what they say, because there's a lot of intelligent people out there who know how to make their words conform to the ideas and concepts of the Bible. But it's all meaningless if in their own lives, if their own choices and in their own actions, they are not actually showing that from the depth of their being, they have authentically embraced the values of the kingdom of God, the truths of the gospel, and the reality of Jesus and what he means and who he is. If they have not authentically embraced that, then there's no reason to listen to them. They are foolish people, not wise people. The reason we listen to people like Paul and John is that they were wise people. They may be jerks, but they knew what this was all about, and we see in their lives that they, I think, authentically embraced all that was true and all that was good and all that was right. Okay? Paul then ends up going into, basically, he's in modern-day Syria at Antioch. He skirts around the northeast edge of the Mediterranean into what is now Turkey, into kind of the south-central part of Turkey, to Lystra, Derbe, Iconium. And that's where Luke takes up the story here in chapter 16. Paul came also to Derbe and to Lystra, and a disciple was there named Timothy, the son of a Jewish woman who was a believer, but his father was a Greek, and he was well spoken of by the brethren who were in Lystra and Iconium. Paul wanted this man to go with him, and he took him and circumcised him because of the Jews who were in those parts, for they all knew that his father was a Greek. Now while they were passing through the cities, they were delivering the decrees which had been decided upon by the apostles and elders who were in Jerusalem for them to observe. So the churches were being strengthened in the faith and were increasing in number daily. Okay, we are introduced to the first time to a man named Timothy. And Timothy is probably quite well known to you. Timothy has two letters named after him in the New Testament. Timothy became basically a lifelong compatriot of Paul's. He wasn't always with Paul. He was oftentimes, as often as not, separated from Paul and doing his own missionary work in some other part of the Roman Empire, but they were constantly in correspondence, and Timothy was clearly a protege of Paul. Here's where Paul and Timothy, I won't say they meet for the first time, because I think in all likelihood Timothy met Paul during the first missionary journey. Timothy is young enough, however, that in all likelihood he was but a child, maybe an older child, but certainly still a child when Paul came through the first time. In the meantime, Timothy not only has clearly become a believer, but he has so matured in wisdom that he has left a very, very positive and favorable impression among the believers in the region. It talks about Lystra and Iconium. Obviously, there must have been some constant interchange between Lystra and Iconium. It appears that Timothy is from Lystra, because Lystra would be closer to Iconium. Derbe would be further removed. So Timothy is probably a native of Lystra. His mother is a Jewish woman. His father is Greek. I can't say this for sure, but the evidence would seem to suggest that his mother is a believer and his father is not a believer. I think that's the significance of him, of Luke writing a Jewish woman who was a believer, but his father was a Greek, to identify his mother as a believer and not say anything with regard to his father, I think is Luke's way of signaling that his father was not a believer. We also know from, I think it's 1 Timothy, it might be 2 Timothy, where Paul introduces the letter, he reminds Timothy of all the things that his grandmother and his mother have taught him in their teaching him the scriptures. He names them by name. It's Lois is his grandmother and Eunice is his mother. And Paul speaks very positively of the incredible heritage that his grandmother and his mother have given him by teaching him the scriptures. So how did this Jewish woman end up marrying this Greek man? I don't know. I mean, because we know that intermarriage between Gentiles and Jews was forbidden and against the law. What was she thinking? You know, what was her spiritual condition? What was her attitude that led her to marry this Greek man? Was she in rebellion against her Judaism and then only later came back to belief in Jesus, perhaps? I don't know. We just don't know the autobiography. But however that happened, this Jewish woman who was, by the traditions of the Jews, forbidden to marry this Greek man, married him, had this child. She became a believer. Her mother was a believer, and their son Timothy was a her son Timothy was a believer. This is the man that becomes Paul's protege here in Lystra. Notice what happens here. Paul has Timothy circumcised. Now, just the chapter before, I mean, we're talking here a matter of months, maybe into years, but not a long span of time before Paul and Barnabas had been traveling to Jerusalem to get settled the issue, do Gentiles have to be circumcised or not? And Paul has been the most powerful proponent of the idea that Gentiles do not have to be circumcised in order to be children of God. They just don't have to be circumcised. Granted, he has a Jewish mother, so he could be, at this time, I'm not sure how they defined who was Jewish and who was not. I know today, modern Jews define whether you're Jewish by whether your mother is Jewish, but that has not always been the case. And I don't know at this point in time whether he would be considered Jewish or not. That may be a factor that's at play in Paul's thinking here. But even if he were construed as a Gentile, the fact that he had a Jewish mother in Paul's mind is going to be problematic, because you have all of these Jews in this region who know Timothy's situation. He has a Jewish mother, he has a Greek father, and the issue is going to be, Paul, what are you going to require of him, Paul, to be circumcised or not? And Paul evidently is judging that his not being circumcised would so cripple him and cripple his credentials in the eyes of the Jewish community around here that he decides it's expedient for you to be circumcised. Okay, well, what gives? If you can be circumcised and still, if you can be uncircumcised and still be saved, why don't you want to send that message to the Jews? Paul goes back and forth on that issue. In Galatians, remember, he refused to have Titus circumcised. Titus, who was clearly a Gentile. He refused to have Titus circumcised. But when it comes to Timothy, he has him circumcised. The only way to understand the criteria by which Paul decides that, I think, is to recognize that he refuses to compromise with the truth. If the issue is, if the message that's going to be sent is, yes, I capitulate, I think you are better off in God's eyes if you're circumcised, then Paul refuses it, because he refuses to allow the truth of our relationship with God to be misconstrued, to be distorted, to be in any way confused. He wants to be clear. God accepts people simply because in his mercy and his grace he accepts them, not because they're Jewish, not because they do anything outwardly that can commend themselves to God. That he wants to be clear about. On the other hand, as he writes in 1 Corinthians, I become all things to all men that I might win some. He doesn't want to put up any roadblocks that are going to prevent him from getting a hearing to begin with. The gospel is too important to let something as trivial as whether you're circumcised or not create a situation where nobody will listen to you. Nobody will give you an ear long enough for you to tell them that you can be justified in God's eyes without being circumcised. He wants that message to them, and he doesn't want any roadblocks or obstacles to people's receiving that. And that seems to be what's at work in Timothy. I know that they're just not going to give you the time of day if they know that you're not circumcised. So Timothy, if you want to be able to proclaim this message to people that includes the message you don't have to be circumcised, you need to be circumcised so that that's not an obstacle. Well, if we're going to have any time for discussion, we're going to run out of time, so let me just stop here, and I'll take your comments or questions.
Where did Mark come from? Was he in a group of guys coming from Jerusalem?
Yes, yes, ultimately. He had traveled early on with Paul and Barnabas. In fact, I think the Acts tells us, I think it was right after their, when they visited what's called the famine visit. There had been a prophecy of a famine in Jerusalem, and Paul and Barnabas took some relief from Antioch down to Jerusalem. And then I think when they returned, John Mark went with them from Jerusalem. John Mark, it appears, piecing everything together, was probably Barnabas' cousin. And John Mark's mother was probably a relatively wealthy woman who owned a home in Jerusalem, and in all likelihood, the room where they had the upper room where they had the Last Supper was probably in John Mark's mother's house. That's a fairly, I think that might even be tradition as well, but it fits the facts quite well, if my memory serves me correctly. So her house seemed to be kind of the center, the home away from home. Whenever Jesus and the disciples were in Jerusalem, that's where they made headquarters, was at John Mark's mother's house.
How many years after Jesus' death do you think this was taking place between Barnabas and Paul?
I'd have to calculate. I'm not sure, but a couple decades. I see that hand.
Should I come forward?
Yeah.
Part of me has this immediate response when you say that Paul was a jerk, which I'm sure you were expecting. Not from me necessarily, but from a lot of people. And I think the thing that is difficult there is painting, you know, this broad brush based upon one incident, labeling a person as something because they were in an instant possibly being a jerk. I think all of us would accept and agree to the fact that we're sinners and do a lot of really stupid things and not only shoot ourselves in the foot, but shoot other people in the process. But can you just deal with that issue? I mean, you are painting a very broad brush based upon that. And of course, that goes to the heart of our, I mean, what's exactly what you're saying? That goes to the heart of our perceptions of people and whether they're wise or not. But there's still that issue of, I mean, I don't see him as a jerk. I see this as a possibly a jerky thing he did. But to color him that way is problematic in my mind.
Okay, yeah, that's a good question. Here's my underlying assumption. My underlying assumption is that Paul is no better than all of you that I interact with all the time. Now, that's probably a very controversial assumption because, you know, we've had thousands of years of calling people like Paul Saint Paul, and what we mean by that is, I mean, our conception, our picture of what it means to be Saint Paul, as opposed to Jerk Paul, is that somehow they are a cut above the rest of us. They really are a different kind of person. Now, I'm not denying that he's a cut above the rest of us in many respects. The function and the role that God gave Paul is unparalleled. I mean, just there aren't very many people in human history who have a more significant role in the transformation of human history by taking the gospel to the world than Paul. And so, yes, he's a cut above us all with respect to the role that God gave him. With respect to wisdom, he's a cut above the rest of us. I grant him authority that I don't grant any of you and that you ought not to grant somebody like me. Everything I know, I will learn from the Apostle Paul. He's way ahead of us all in his grasp of what the Scriptures teach, what the Old Testament Scriptures teach, what Jesus came and taught, how they all fit together, who God is, what life is, who human beings are. He's a cut above us all in that respect as well. But with respect to his humanity as such, is the fact that he's a cut above us in those other two respects reason to elevate him in our thinking with respect to his moral nature as well? And I see no reason why. That's the remarkable thing about what God is doing in the world, is God is doing an amazing thing in history, but he's not doing it cleanly. It's a pretty messy process that all of us are in and that human history itself is in. I don't know why we'll have to take it up with him. I mean, he's God, not Walt Disney, but it's pretty messy. That's an assumption I'm making, and that may be a false assumption, but it's an assumption I'm making, is that he really is like the rest of us. Well, when I make that assumption, then I look at myself, and I look at all of you, and I ask myself the question, you know, who are we really? And who we are people that have evil has made such an ingression into us, into our very personalities, that we couldn't extricate ourselves from all the manifestations of evil even if we tried, because it's embedded in the very nature of who I am as a person. We tend to dismiss it for that reason. You know, there's two ways you can look at human personality. People are different. People just are the way they are. Give them a break. You know, don't call that evil. Just recognize that that's part of the diversity and the differences among human beings. That's true, and there's an element of our differences that's the only way to understand them. But is it not also the case that our personalities are rooted in and arise out of, are nurtured by, and are created by the evil within us as well? You know, how much of our personalities are driven by fears that by all rights ought not to be there? Fears that are rooted in our evil. Pride that is rooted in my evil. Lies and deceptions that are rooted in my evil. How much of my personality are various strategies that I have just made so habitual that they are mine, strategies that wouldn't be there and shouldn't be there were I a perfect human individual? So I take a more jaundiced view toward human personality, in the sense that there are some aspects of who I am, some personal values that I have, that in the kingdom of God I assume will not be there, because I, being so transformed, it will actually alter my personality itself. I won't have the same fears, I won't have the same drives, I won't have the same commitments that just make me who I am today. So I think that can be true of Paul just as easily as it can be true of me. That Paul had a strength of personality. Obviously he had to have a strong personality to do what he did and to put up with what he did. Was all of the strength of his personality good and righteous and holy? Probably not. Any more than it is for us. Did you have it?
Well, huh? Yeah, I have no disagreement to all that you just said, and the fundamental acceptance that Paul was a sinner like any. Maybe my own problem. I try not to, as much as I can, generalize about any one person. I mean, I can point to a lot of people who have a lot of sins and consistent sins, but I guess to label them as this type of person might be going too far in my mind, and that might be my own sensitivity there, but
you're right. Obviously I'm using it as a rhetorical device, and there's a certain amount of it's intended to be jarring. My basic point is that he's evil, and that's really the only point I'm trying to get across. We oftentimes reserve the word jerk for actually foolish people, and Paul is not a jerk in that sense at all. So in that sense it does seem to be a mislabel. If we are looking at it that way, and you're right, then it would be a mislabel, because I'm not for a second suggesting that he's a person who's foolishly committed to self-centeredness in the way that we think of your typical jerk as being. So that in that sense, it is a mislabel. That's true. Don?
Can we still look at Paul as a sort of a role model, even though he's a jerk?
Well, yes and no. A role model with respect to his wisdom, not with respect to absolutely everything that he does. I mean, that's a good question. I mean, that when we look up to people who are leading us, it's important that we be selective about what we make our role model, which part of them, you know, the wisdom that they are manifesting or their personality. I may need to reject aspects of their personality, discerning that it's not good, and not make him a role model in that respect.
So this guy that you looked up to in the church when you were growing up, would you call him a role model even though you...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Was he an angel?
Pardon?
Was he an angel?
No. By the way, he told us he wasn't an angel, too.
I was just going to say there's many examples in the Bible where God used someone who we would consider less than optimum for some position. In fact, a lot of times he uses someone who you think would be the exact opposite of who should be in that position.
Right.
So there's many examples already of that. And then I think you were also saying this is another case where you could also like kind of separate the message from the messenger. And I know like in our society today, we say, oh, the message is bad because, you know, like maybe someone is speaking out on marriage, but he had a traffic ticket, so that nullifies the whole thing, you know, non sequitur there.
Right, yeah, very good point. I mean, we do ultimately need to judge the message on its own merits, period, quite apart from the messenger. That's true. That's absolutely true. But it does get more complicated than that, because oftentimes teachers and leaders are actually suggesting in a variety of ways, let me be your wisdom for you. You know, let me tell you how to look at life. And that's when it becomes important that, I mean, and there's a sense in which that can be appropriate. That there are people that I want to say, how do you see life? Because I trust how you see life, then it becomes all important. The thing I was making earlier, the point I was making earlier, I need to watch their actions and see if they are wise people. If I'm going to look at life the way they're looking at life, then they need to show themselves and demonstrate themselves wise people before I do that. But in the end, you're absolutely right. In the end, the message stands or falls by itself. It doesn't need to be credentialed by any sort of quality in the messenger. Many, many true things have been said by totally inauthentic people.
I'm unclear as to the part where you're talking about, like siding with Paul on the disagreement, mm-hmm. there, because it seems from the part that when it says like Barnabas took Mark and sailed away, and Paul chose Silas and departed, being commended by the brethren to the grace of God. Seems to me that the people around them were in support of Paul's decision. And I mean, seems to me like it may be nothing more than a stylist, you know, like a style difference of Paul saying, I'm not going to take quitters. Barnabas is saying it's not that big of a deal. You know, he's still a man. He's still a godly man. Let's take him. And Paul just says, you know, we gave him a chance and he didn't do it. You know, and is that really evidence of, you know, the evil that you speak of, or more of just the style, you know, type of style difference? And then how does it seem that the people that were around supported Paul as opposed to Barnabas?
Well, that's a good question. Calvin takes this as demonstrating that Paul had the blessing and Barnabas did not. It's not clear to me that that's what that means, because Luke is following the story of Paul. I don't think we can even conclude necessarily that Barnabas was not committed by the brethren to the grace of the Lord. They may both have been committed, but the Acts, the storyline of Acts, does not follow Barnabas' journeys at all. And primarily the reason for that is because Luke becomes a lifelong partner of Paul. The tradition says, to the day he died, was the constant traveling companion of Paul. And so Luke has access to that information. He knows that story, and that's the story he's telling. We'll meet Luke here in the next chapter. So I think we can't really, given what Acts is, that it's the story of Paul and his adventures, I don't think we can conclude that the church was not equally supportive of Barnabas. If they were supportive of Paul over Barnabas, even then, what weighs stronger to me than the support of the church, because we know how political human interactions can be. Even if they were supportive of Paul over Barnabas, it still seems to me that a combination of two things put Paul in a bad light. One, Paul himself teaches us the importance of mercy and forbearance. He is not, however you look at this, Paul is not being merciful and he's not being forbearing. Now we could say, yeah, but sometimes wisdom trumps forbearance and mercy. That's true. I mean, what I mean by that is, you may be forbearing and you may be merciful, but you don't take him on the journey. That's true. I mean, wisdom, the better part of wisdom may say, we don't take John Mark on the journey. Not out of bitterness, not out of rancor, not out of a desire, not out of a punitive motive, but just wisdom. And so we could read it in that light, but the problem is, the record goes on to show, Barnabas was right in his judgment of John Mark, and Paul was not. And if it's just the better part of wisdom, why the sharp disagreement leading to the alienation? I mean, you can even decide, well, I'll tell you what, Barnabas, go ahead and take John Mark and take him to Cyprus, and I'll take Silas and we'll go here, and leave on completely mutually supportive, amicable terms. And maybe this is amicable, but it doesn't look like it to me. It seems to me that Luke is trying to suggest by this language, sharp disagreement, that we're dealing with real alienation here. And if that's the case, then it doesn't look like Paul is simply saying it's the better part of wisdom, but let's be merciful and forbearing. It seems to me that he's being stubbornly punitive somehow. John Mark abandoned me, so no way am I going to be supportive of him now. But it is a judgment call, there's a lot of things we don't know that could color the picture differently.
So then the real issue would be the division between Barnabas and Paul as
right.
Evidence of conflict.
Right, exactly. That, for me, that's what weighs heavily.
If you wouldn't mind clarifying one thing, maybe not
sure.
Clarifying, but I've heard you teach for 18 years, and I've heard you teach in depth on this one thing that you went over lightly today. When you were talking about Paul and the jerk mess,
mm-hmm.
One thing that can be confusing that I know you never mean it to me is when you first started talking about it today, you said, you know, we're jerks, and there was kind of a lightness to it, and then you quickly changed and you said that that's not a good thing or something like that. And the part that I think is so important that you teach, you said one time to me, and it was life-changing, was that, yes, we're a jerk, but that's not a credit card. I mean, that's not something, I mean, that grieves us as a believer. That brings us tremendous sadness when we see our fallenness. So for anybody that's new and kind of felt, I mean, I just wanted to, you feel that way, right?
Sure. Yeah. No, thank you.
I mean, that's not just a, yeah, I'm a jerk, kind of like, so take it or leave it. But that would be, as a believer, just grieving to us.
Yeah. Thank you. That's a good point. We must have two attitudes towards sin simultaneously. This is the balancing act of the Christian faith. We must be okay with it and not at all okay with it at the same time, in different senses, of course. We must be okay with it in the sense that we have come to fully recognize that my not being okay is not going to be held against me when it comes to doling out citizenship in the kingdom of heaven. My eternal well-being is not dependent upon me being worthy, upon me being okay, upon me being an acceptable person in God's eyes. So I have to take the attitude toward my sin that it's not okay in the sense that it's a grievous matter, it's a serious matter, it's the very thing that makes me, in God's eyes, morally unworthy, and if God were to do the right thing, he would condemn me to eternal destruction. That's how serious my sin and my evil is. Even that stuff that's so built into my personality that I could never eradicate it in this lifetime is such a serious matter that it makes me worthy of eternal destruction. So in that sense, it's not okay at all. But in the other sense, that's not going to be held against me. God, in his grace and in his mercy, is going to overlook that, is going to pass that by and grant me eternal life anyway. So it's no threat to me. And that's the sense in which we need to be able to get okay with our sinfulness, is recognize that it's no threat to me. And since it's no threat to me, I can be utterly honest, transparent, and straightforward about it. I don't have to try to hide it and pretend that maybe I can hide it from God and maybe he will not think I'm worthy of eternal destruction. I don't need to worry about eternal destruction because that's not going to be the basis upon which any of us are there anyway. Yeah, that is, on the basis of worthiness. So when I get released from the notion that I have to be acceptable, I have to be worthy, then I can get completely objective about this thing and come to see myself truly and accurately exactly as God would see me. And the way he sees me is, I ain't doing too good. But I love you, I'm committed to you, I have made a place for you in the kingdom of God, and it's yours anyway, in spite of the fact that you haven't really earned your right there, you haven't really made yourself worthy of that. So we need to have both of those attitudes simultaneously. Recognize it's something to grieve over, but it's not something to be threatened by at all. Does that help? Okay. We're a little over time, so we better wrap it up. Thank you.